I had a different place to start tonight, but I'm going to start with something that Rebecca and I were talking about downstairs, which is I think a lot of people have come thinking, Rebecca has the answer. Rebecca has the clarity. Rebecca's out there sharing her words of wisdom. And this struck me with what you said downstairs, that you don't feel like you have all of the clarity either, and you don't have all the answers, and you need to take some time to think things through for yourself. And you may not come out on the other end of that with the clear answer.
Yeah, I certainly don't have answers. I don't think, and one of the things that I've been really passionate about, and this conviction started building in me actually during the 2016 election, when because I write about women in politics, I was covering the Hillary Clinton campaign very closely. I was covering the Trump campaign. I was writing about the gendered and racial and economic kind of conversations that were happening around that election. I was sometimes asked to go on cable news. Right, which is how a lot of us, and sometimes on radio, how a lot of us are hearing this interpreted. And I was always asked, what's going to happen tomorrow, you know, the day before a primary? And I would often say, I don't know. I don't know. And sometimes that was greeted with some derision, like, why are you here if you don't know? But this has become, I began to feel very strongly about it during that period, because I know the people in my industry. And I think that one of the problems is that we are offering a kind of authority about what happens next. It's not, nobody knows what's going to happen next. Don't listen to the people on TV who tell you with assuredness what's going to happen, who's going to win, exactly how to read this poll. I mean, there are people who have a lot of insight about how polling works and how demographics work, certainly about gerrymandering, voter suppression. Listen to all the people who are offering analysis that you find compelling and clarifying, but do not listen to the people who are promising you that there are answers, because that is kind of an anesthetic. I think we long for it because we want somebody to tell us what's going to happen next, in part because we want somebody to tell us that it's going to get better without us having to do the hard part. And the hard part comes from not knowing and working hard and being scared and quite often losing and continuing to work hard and continuing to be scared and continuing to care and continuing to fight. That's harder than somebody coming and saying, well, the polls tell us that this is what's going to happen. Then you get to be sort of passive and say, okay, now I know.
I think this is refreshing because we gravitate towards certainty. I mean, cable, you've just kind of described it. Cable news has made a business out of that. People who come on and say, I know because. And you're not afraid, as I think a lot of women are not afraid to say, I don't know. I'm not certain. I'm waiting to learn, right?
You've just reminded me that I have been chided in my life by television producers. If I am, sometimes you're asked to come on in this business of cable news where you're coming on to fill the time, right? You're producing their content as a talking head. And so very often, if I'm asked to come on to talk about a story I've just reported or something that I have some expertise on, of course, like, it's a wonderful opportunity to be able to talk to a different kind of audience and all of that. But there have been times when you're asked to come on to talk about something that you're not an expert on. And I will say, no, I've always said, no, I'm not going to come on and talk about, you know, the tax policy, because I'm not going to offer anything on tax policy. And I have been chided on several occasions by producers who say, men never say that. Men always come on. I mean, and sort of shamed from a feminist perspective, like, you're not grabbing the ring here like you should, because you have imposter syndrome or whatever. And I'm like, no, I genuinely know nothing about tax policy. You shouldn't put me on television to talk about it. But I have been told over and over again, men never say that. They come on and figure out something to say about tax policy.
Isn't this also part of why, and I think this is changing, and I hope it is, but this is part of the reason that women have held back from running for public office, because they have believed that they needed to do more learning about the issues and blah, blah, blah. Often men will say, I can do that.
Yes.
I'll learn it along the way.
That is, many people who have studied the patterns around who runs and who doesn't run and who needs to be told multiple times that they should run, women are far more likely to say, I don't know how to do that job. I don't know about tax policy. for instance, you know?
Right.
And men are like, yeah, no, I should run. I'd be great at that. And that's the, you know, there's the old joke about, you know, who looks in the, you know, it's who looks in the mirror and sees a president. But that really has to do with the models that we see in front of us, right? This is why it matters. This is why diversity amongst candidates and certainly diversity in our governing bodies matters. I mean, matters for a lot of reasons, but part of it is expanding the model that we can imagine for what leadership looks like, right? I still remember in 2008, the debate, the first debate after John Edwards left the race. He was my candidate. You should always listen to me about politics. But the first primary debate in 2008, where Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama were on a stage, and it was the first time not in my life, but also the first time in American history that there was a presidential debate and there was no white man on the stage. That alters, so there are two people and we're getting our eyes and our ears used to what presidential can look like, used to what leadership can look like in a very different form than what has always been presented to us. That's part of the process we're going through.
This is interesting. I've just been reading some of the work of social psychologist Mahzarin Banaji about implicit bias. Mm-hmm. She uses the word implicit, not subconscious, because subconscious seems to indicate to people that I have no control over it and it's just this wild imagination kind of thing my brain does. I mean, her work says just what you've described. We are conditioned pretty constantly without really understanding why we're being conditioned to believe certain things. The tone of a woman's voice, what leadership looks like. Why certainty and authority looks and sounds better coming from men than it does from women.
What kind of voices are permitted to be angry in a way that is compelling and persuasive?
Exactly. Here we are.
But that is... around anger, that is also part of the process that we're going through. And so there isn't... You know, we can look, for example, at the testimony of Christine Blasey Ford versus Brett Kavanaugh, and we see a perfect example of what has historically been true, that there was no way that she could have used anger, even though she had every right to be angry about a whole series of things, beginning with the alleged assault and continuing through the impact that it's had on her life. But had she raised her voice, spoken back to the judiciary with contempt or challenge, had she been angry, it would have undermined her case, right? Me, who's just written this book about the political consequence of anger, I was sitting there happy that she wasn't expressing herself through anger because...
Were you?
Well, happy. I mean, I recognized what was going on, and I knew it would have backfired on her. It would have immediately rendered her story unreliable. It would have been too emotional. Women are presumed to be emotional and fundamentally irrational. White men are presumed to be fundamentally rational, are normative citizens. So their expression starts from a baseline. We assume that they're offering something based in reason, that we attach a sense of political viability to them automatically. So for a woman who's presumed to be irrational, apolitical, marginalized in all these ways, if she gets angry, it reads as extra emotional and therefore less rational. That's how we get to unhinged, hysterical, unbelievable. It was interesting. I was noting she's a scientist and the way that she rooted so many of her answers in the science. She was hammering home, I know what I'm talking about. I have authority here. Women have to prove authority. And any trace of anger takes them right off that course. For men who are white men who have presumed authority, anger, it's not only that women aren't allowed to be angry and be persuasive, and men are, it's that men can use anger to amplify their authority. They're extra reasonable. They're extra righteous if they're using anger to bolster their point. And that's part of what we saw. But then the next day, we saw anger expressed in a way that is relatively new, and I still...
You mean to Jeff Flake?
To Jeff Flake. Yeah. Ana Maria Archila and Maria Gallagher yelling at him in an elevator, and it's funny, on this book tour, I've heard that clip so many times, every time I hear it, I get choked up, because it is so powerful to hear such direct and impassioned anger directed at a powerful man by women who have no power in this situation. They are the women who are not being listened to, who are not being believed, who are about to get run over by a Senate that's going to confirm this guy anyway. And yet they have a powerful man in their sights, and they can point a finger and demand that he look at them. And it is so powerful. And that's a view of, again, it's like that debate where there wasn't, we're getting adjusted to being able to hear women express themselves that way. And that clip had power. It resonated for people, for millions of people who were angry around the country and felt isolated in their anger and like they were crazy. Did I not see what's going on? And then to hear it voiced by these women in this clip that goes viral, that has a communicative and a connective power that means something. And I believe that clip will mean something 10 years down the road, 20 years down the road. Because that is part of the expansion of how we can hear women's voices and understand them to be meaningful and politically persuasive.
Did you find his response, body language, reaction pretty insightful to, I mean, what did you make of it, what he did? And you know what else I've wondered? Well, the other thing I've wondered is, what if that had been Lindsey Graham standing in, who has been much more belligerent about this? But talk about Jeff Flake's reaction.
Well, I think he was scared.
Right.
And now, that could have gone in a couple of ways, because one of the things is when women or marginalized people express their anger at injustice, they are immediately framed as the aggressors. That's what we're hearing when we hear that left-wing mob that's coming, right? And so part of the reflexive reaction is to say, and there are a million examples of this, you know, they were scary, they were aggressive. So part of what he was doing could have been then read, because he was like looking down and he
right.
couldn't meet their eyes and he was cornered in the elevator. And
right.
it could have been recast as very, very swiftly as these women cornered poor Jeff Flake, right? It wasn't.
Right.
And he knew
Why?
Something about the changing dynamics of this moment. I don't want to give him too much credit. He performed respect. Okay? He performed respect. I would love to believe that he was actually affected. Like, I, as a human being who have now, this clip has been played for me 20 times in the past few weeks, and I still will cry. I want to believe, I would like to believe that Jeff Flake heard those voices and was, and felt shame and an emotion. I don't know if that's true, because what he then did was do a performance of listening to them that wound up with a sham investigation, which just kept, you know, running through exactly what they were always going to do anyway. So I don't know how he was actually feeling in the moment. It could have been fear that he knew there was a camera there and that this was going to, I mean, he might have known in the moment that
knew that there was a camera.
Yeah, he knew there was a camera there.
Right.
But it is true, if you watch... It was Orrin Hatch who said, oh, grow up.
Right.
Grow up.
Right.
And you know, he has no shame about it. When there was a protester in the first part of the hearings, when there were, before the assault allegations, there were protesters who were coming in and yelling about the overturn of Roe v. Wade and the repeal of health care. And those were, I was deeply moved by those protesters too. And what Orrin Hatch said about one of them, a woman who got up and said, if you repeal health care, I will die. Orrin Hatch, while on the Judiciary Committee in front of not just somebody's camera in an elevator, but, you know, news cameras broadcasting this, said, get this loudmouth out of here. We shouldn't have to deal with this. Which is the exact language he later used about Christine Blasey Ford's allegations. We shouldn't have to deal with this. The fact is that a lot of those powerful guys feel that they are entitled to not have to listen to the angry voices of the people they are trying to oppress.
Sometimes I think... Sometimes I think you could teleport through history Susan B. Anthony and Harriet Tubman and Florence Kennedy and they would recognize exactly what you've described, right? This Absolutely. Sense of no right to be openly angry, perceived and ridiculed as being irrational and hysterical. This would look shockingly familiar
Yes.
to them.
Yes, it absolutely would. One of the things, you know, we are not taught so much about our history, and especially about the history of how subjugated populations have resisted their subjugation. Sometimes in, you know, we get sort of easy stories about social movements. We know about the civil rights movement. We know a sort of vague history about a gay rights movement and a women's movement of the 1970s. But so much of the texture of those, of that history is never taught to us. And as a feminist journalist, when I started as a feminist journalist 15 years ago, I didn't have any of this history. I'd never taken women's studies, and I'd never been taught any of this in school. And the process of learning to be a better feminist and a better writer has been me seeking out education that I wasn't ever offered.
So why do you think that is?
Well, I think that this country in general likes to congratulate itself on having gotten better and having fixed problems without ever really looking hard at certainly what's gone unfixed or about how long and difficult and at various times nearly impossible it was to make even the fixes that we have.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think we like to look at the hard history of struggle and fighting and oppression because it's not flattering to us.
It's much more palatable to have it in the rearview mirror than to be accepting that it wasn't completely fixed. We're all living with the consequences of that.
And more than that, I think we also like to present ugly stereotypes about those who have fought before us, either ugly stereotypes or completely cleaned up versions of what happened.
Such as?
Well, for example, there's the ugly stereotyping of the women's movement of the 1970s, which in its anger and its radicalism got presented to my generation. I was born in 1975. And, you know, growing up in the 80s and 90s, it was an absolute frozen tundra of anti-feminist backlash, in which the stories that I was told about that movement that had altered the laws and economic and educational and legal possibilities for me and altered the shape of my life and all kinds of possibilities, that the women who'd fought for those changes were, you know, humorless, sexless, ugly, angry, unpleasant women. I mean, that was the anti-feminist
just
story.
Nasty women.
Nasty,
all the
way around, right? And there was none of, and first of all, many of them were very angry. Many of them were angry at each other. There's all kinds of internal dissent that we also don't like to look too closely at because it makes us uncomfortable because we see all the levels of inequity and how they're repeated even within progressive coalitions.
That's
right. Yes, that's one of the things I write about. But also, we lose the joy and the passion and the humor because those women who were angry and who were radical in some of their aims were also, you know, funny and connected and full of joy and hope, and all of that has gotten erased. And then by the same token, you look at something like that we do sort of celebrate in an easy way, which is how I was taught about the civil rights movement.
Mm-hmm.
And I write specifically in here about Rosa Parks, mm-hmm. and how I was taught about Rosa Parks. And she is one of those women who you're taught about in school, right? She's not lost to time. But I was taught that Rosa Parks was extremely tired and that she was very stoic. And I was taught that she was a seamstress. I don't know why this sticks out. What other people taught this to, that like she was a seamstress and she was very demurely dressed and like, this is the version of Rosa Parks I was taught.
That there was a great humility.
Deep humility.
About her.
Yes.
Persona, right?
Yes.
And that fits
the gentleness,
narrative.
A gentleness.
Right.
And here are things I was not taught about Rosa Parks. That she was a lifelong, furious fighter against racism, racial violence, and inequality, that she was an investigator for the NAACP in the Jim Crow South, that she investigated the gang rape of black women by white men and investigated false claims of sexual assault made against black men by white women, that anger at injustice motivated so much of her life's work, and that that choice to sit on the bus did not stem from exhaustion and stoicism. It was a political act. I mean, I'm sure she was tired. But so there's a double process when we try to go and learn our own history. First, we have to find the women in it. And then when we find the women, we have to find a realer and more textured story about what motivated them and who they really were, and not just who it's comfortable for us to understand them as.
You know, Gloria Steinem was here a couple years ago, sitting in that chair, and your book made me think about how she became the face of the women's movement. Now, she makes a point, as you know, of saying, look, this really picked up steam when I was going out to college campuses with Florence Kennedy, and she was the one that would really get fired up on the campus, and she built this movement. But who ends up as the face of it? Gloria Steinem. To some degree, I wonder if that's, you know, her vibe, cool, sarcastic, kind of dry. She was mad, but she had a very cool kind of persona. And I wonder now, after reading your book, if that's part of the reason she ended up being the poster girl for the movement.
Well, I think that that's probably part of it. And I think that she would not disagree with the fact that it was also that she was white, that she was traditionally very beautiful and glamorous.
She does not like to hear that.
No. Well, but this is true. And to say those things does not take away from the work that she did in any way. But we cannot pretend that we do not live in a country that values certain kinds of femininity over others. It was, you know, when I wrote my book about unmarried women, one of the things that I had to think about with regard to Gloria Steinem was the fact that she, as a single woman who didn't get married, as she did much later in her life, but, you know, who said things like a woman needs a man like a fish needs a bicycle, that message in part resonated because she also was, all the aspersions cast on women who didn't marry didn't work on Gloria Steinem. She was beautiful. She was heterosexual. She was open about her heterosexuality. She dated a lot of people. And so she couldn't be written off in the grotesquely unjust ways that so many other women are written off.
You quote, and it sounds like you did an event with Black Lives Matter co-founder Alicia Garza.
Yes, right? Yes, last week in San Francisco.
Okay. I think what she says about this is really essential to understand what she told you for the book. Our anger gets dismissed and devalued and gaslighted. We're angry because people are telling us what is happening to us right in front of our faces is not, in fact, happening. And that is crazy to me. Mm-hmm. What else did she say to you about that?
Well, I think that this speaks to, I mentioned the sort of decades in which there was an anti-feminist backlash, but also this sort of myth after the major social movements of the late 20th century. This story was pushed on us that we were post-race, post-feminist, that these movements had fixed the problems, and that there was nothing legitimate to be angry about anymore. But this is a really pernicious thing because, as I said, I said earlier, it's easier to believe that, especially if you're in a position of privilege where you can reap the benefits of the liberties and new opportunities that have been won by social movements. And of course, for many people who have big platforms and speak to the media and tell the story of America, they were in positions to reap those benefits and to not feel injustice in the same way that so many Americans have never stopped experiencing injustice and inequality. But this message that, and it's been felt in so many ways, that to be angry at state-sponsored racism and racial violence and, you know, systemic misogyny and vast economic inequality, that this is somehow illegitimate because, you know, we fixed a lot of these problems, that has created, it creates isolation. Because if you're told that your anger is illegitimate, that you're borrowing this, I mean, this was true in the run-up to the 2016 election, that anybody who was angry about misogyny with regard to Hillary Clinton, for example, and there are a million other angles we could take on this, was told that they were kind of being Hillbot fangirl, performing unnecessary feminist anger. After all, she was the one who had the power. This was not untrue. She did have tremendous power. She'd worked her way up within a system. But she was the establishment. To be angry in any way on her behalf for reasons having to do with feminism or misogyny was performed. It was anger borrowed from an earlier time. Now she was the inevitable president. There was nothing to be angry about. And you can see the same thing, what Alicia Garza, in part, I think, is talking about, and she there is speaking specifically about black women,
right,
in that African Americans are shot and killed by police, a movement springs up protesting that and making the systemic nature of that violence visible to so many, and yet those who are voicing their anger are called by mainstream outlets terrorists, a hate group. Meghan McCain called Black Lives Matter a hate group. And so there's this idea that anger isn't righteous, and it's misplaced, and it's threatening, and it's scary and disruptive, or it's theatrical and laughable and marginal. There are all these ways in which the anger of subjugated and oppressed people is written off as somehow illegitimate. And if you're one of the people who is angry, it can make you feel deeply, deeply isolated, crazy, which is what she's talking about there, the gaslighting. And that's one of the things that's happened. One of the valuable things about Donald Trump and this particular era, I don't see Trump as different from his party in terms of his aims. The thing is, he makes it visible. Right? And so you
and
don't
you
have
say
to say
that,
no, there is misogyny because your president is calling somebody horseface. Like, there's, you don't have to make the argument that there's misogyny.
When you say that, Rebecca, you mean he's unapologetic about his views and opinions and the insults that he throws women's way in a way that I think you're saying other members of his party who agree with him on this would know to cover. Is
yes.
that what you're saying?
Oh, yeah. For years, the Republican Party has been pushing towards these same policies, the ones that fundamentally, I mean, this is what the court is going to do, right? This is the goal of a right-wing Supreme Court. It is to undo the progress and the victories made by previous generations, centuries of social movements. So we already partially gutted the Voting Rights Act. There'll be more of that. Truly, getting rid of the Voting Rights Act, overturning Roe in whatever form that's going to take, making reproductive autonomy inaccessible and illegal, gutting collective bargaining rights. These are the victories that were won over centuries by mass movements and mass social movements. And that is the agenda of a Republican Party representing a fundamentally white capitalist patriarchal system that has been challenged by those victories, those you know, grinding years of mass movement that have achieved some wins, is to undo those wins. Right? That's been the project long before Donald Trump. But that party prettied it up, made it set, you know, gave lip service to being a party that was friendly to women, Mama Grizzlies. You know, like there's a they knew better. And in fact, and it worked insofar as when Donald Trump said the things he said on the campaign trail, when he was openly racist and talked about Mexican rapists and talked about protesters in the good old days, they used to beat them up and, of course, called women pigs and dogs and all of that. What we were told by a news media, it's that version of that, like, you have nothing to really be angry about. We were told that that would disqualify him, that he wasn't really a serious threat, because, of course, we live in a country that knows better than this, that we've fixed these problems. And so his racism and his misogyny and his xenophobia was going to be ultimately disqualifying, because we're better than that. And that's part of that lie I'm describing, You know, the anesthesia that tells us we're fine from this because this makes him an outlier who's not going to win the nomination, and he's certainly not going to win over the people who have real power, you know, the Barack Obama and Hillary Clinton. And what was not visible, because both the right and I think a mainstream media that and the stories we tell ourselves in America about us having come further than we ever have, actually have. What we were unable to discern is that we still run on racism, xenophobia, and misogyny. And that those weren't disqualifiers, they were his greatest weapons. And that's what's exposed. And it's still up for debate, believe me. Everywhere, you know, people, we're told all the time that it's not really that the appeal is sexism or racism. Right? We're told that all the time.
I'm interested in what I know you were writing about Hillary Clinton during the campaign, much to the chagrin you've said of the Bernie Sanders, the burners, right? We're mad at you.
Oh, yeah.
That.
I like, my politics are much closer to Bernie's. I did prefer Hillary, but I liked both of them. I would have been thrilled to vote for either of them.
Hillary Clinton's very modulated reaction to some of the things that President Trump said.
Mm-hmm.
For me, I understand this a little better now that mm-hmm. I've read your book. She was very careful about the way she would talk about some of the things that he was saying. And I think she also assumed, as you've said, that it was so disqualifying that she didn't need to really say anything about it.
Yeah, I think she hoped, I think that she hoped that it was so disqualifying that she didn't need to say anything about it. You know, it is interesting looking back. Part of what I write about in the book is how, you know, and not a lot of it is about 2016, but I write about how both of her opponents, both Bernie Sanders and Donald Trump, did that thing I talked about with regard to Kavanaugh. They used anger brilliantly, right? It was part of the talent, their talent as campaigners. They were able to challenge the fury about inequality and perceived inequality or status loss in the case of Donald Trump. They were able to channel that anger. They yelled, they ranted.
I mean, think of Bernie Sanders, you know, spit flying out of his mouth.
Right.
Can you imagine a woman being able to have that kind of style?
No, you can't. And in fact, whenever Hillary talked too close to the microphone, somebody said that she was shrill and yelling at them. And it's true. Again, let me just implicate myself here. I would be like hiding under my couch, being like, "Stop yelling!" Because
Bernie or Hillary Clinton?
Hillary. I mean, but I know, I understood why that's a problematic response, but it's the same reason why when Christine Blasey Ford is offering her testimony and telling everybody how collegial she wants to be,
right.
I understand that that's a way to, like, your only path that's open to you. If you want to persuade powerful people that you're legitimate. And that's wrong. I want that to change. But it's also an acknowledgement because I could hear how that... And the other thing is we can't take away that Hillary Clinton had been trained as a woman in this world for all of her decades of life.
Right.
And that how do you... So no, she wasn't good at persuasively yelling because every one of us has been told not to yell. And she writes in her memoir at great length about the kind of voice coaching she got about how not to yell too loud and not to sound too aggressive. But one of the amazing things that I write about, she also talks about the effort that she made in the second debate where Trump is like standing behind her pawing the ground, looking like a stalker. And it was so horrifying. I mean, do you guys remember the visceral horror of watching that and being like, what is happening? Like, he is just stalking her. What's going on? It's a debate. She described to me in an interview, and then later she wrote about it in her memoir, how in her head, as that presidential debate is going on, she's doing the math in her head of, like, can I turn around on this guy and say, get away from me? Which she says she wanted to do, but she's thinking, if I do that, it's going to redound negatively to me.
She's running through all of the calculations in the moment.
Yes, and she doesn't do it. And I think that was right because later, you know, it's funny. After maybe the week after that debate, I was on Bill Maher, and there was a conversation where he said she should have turned around and, you know, kicked him in the... I don't remember what he said, but yeah. She should have turned around and challenged him. And I was like, my man. That was not going to go well, because then it would be she was playing the victim card. She was playing it up. She was performing outrage. She was trying to elicit sympathy. He really got to her. You know, like there'd be all this analysis of how, it would not have helped her. And the fact is, the sad irony is everybody agreed she won that debate.
Right.
Right? But she didn't win the election. Well, right.
Oh, no. Are we going down the popular vote versus the...
That matters, though. It does matter.
I want to come back to something that Alicia talked to you about, and you've probably had conversations with her. She brings up Audre Lorde, the feminist and civil rights activist, and you quote Alicia saying this: "For black women and white women to face one another's angers without denial or immobility or silence or guilt is in itself a heretical and generative idea." How so?
Well, one of the things that all kinds of progressive coalitions have had to reckon with, and this is actually the popular vote comment plays into this a little bit. The way the power structure works in the United States is that it's built on minority rule. There was a population of white men who built our government and our economy and our laws, our courts, our policies around their own power, their own public, economic, civic power, based on the disenfranchisement of the unenfranchisement of a majority population, the enslavement of a population, the lack of extension of you know, legal and economic rights and civic participation to a population of women. And so it's you have a majority that historically has been denied access to the kind of power that has remained largely, I mean, look at our federal bodies, you know, remained largely in the hands of white men. So how does minority rule persist within theoretically a democracy? In part by dividing the majority against itself. And you do that by extending certain benefits. And the person who's helped me think through this the most is Brittany Cooper, who's a women and gender studies professor at Rutgers. And I cite her in this book. And her book, Eloquent Rage, is so beautiful on this topic. And she's helped me think this through so much. So what do? You extend to certain members of the population patriarchal power within relationships and at work. And that extends to men across races, certain forms of patriarchal power. And to other members of this majority, you extend the benefits of white supremacy. And that works to incentivize a protection of and defense of white patriarchal power structures for white women who are proximal to white men, who enjoy the advantages of white supremacy, who enjoy proximal access to that kind of white patriarchal power through marriage, through families, through their, you know, through neighborhoods, through relationships that they have to white men. Now, what that means practically is when portions of that majority do organize and start to form bonds and coalitions to work to challenge the power, what are repeated within those coalitions are inequities that in many ways echo the inequities that the coalition is joining forces to fight. So within, it's not just the feminist movement. Within a civil rights movement, it's been riven by sexism and homophobia and economic inequality. That's been true of all kinds of left movements. Within the women's movement, which is a majority movement because it's a majority population that is subjugated, there are so many inequalities repeated, and one of the most pernicious of them has been racial inequality. And this is particularly pernicious in part, the end of Brittany Cooper's lesson about how these power structures work is that because black women have never been offered the incentives of either patriarchy or white supremacy, it's one of the reasons that they've been the pioneering thinkers and leaders and organizers of the very progressive movements from which they are then erased when more powerful people come in. And so you have black women who are often, again, these pioneering thinkers. It's you talking about Flo Kennedy. How many people here know the name Flo Kennedy? A few. But how many people know the name Gloria Steinem? They were speaking partners. They traveled the country together. You know, how many people know who Pauli Murray is? Anybody know who Polly Murray is? Great. She was a non-gender conforming black woman whose legal writing on both gendered and racial inequality was so fundamental and laid the groundwork that both Thurgood Marshall and Ruth Bader Ginsburg publicly credited her with doing the work on which they base so many of their legal decisions. But Polly Murray is not somebody who is known to us. And so a women's movement has to confront the history of this inequality, its internal racism, in addition to its homophobia, its classism, all of these other inequities that are repeated within the coalition, the progressive coalition. But there are arguments about how best to do this, and if it's even possible. It's an open question.
I was telling you about the forum that we had the night of the Kavanaugh testimony. My friend Sina is here, actually, co-moderating with 100 women in our forum, and the idea was, how can we be allies to one another in Me Too across race and geography and income and some of the other barriers? And I think the revelation, and I think part of this is the answer to what you've just described, is truly engaged listening, so that when women of color in that forum stand up and tell Sina and I that it is exhausting to always modulate your anger and frustration and be constantly self-aware of how you're presenting and having to be thinking about the ways you're being judged in ways that I don't have to think about, and to have an experience of being truly listened to, mm-hmm. I hope that's part of the answer to what you've just described.
It is my hope that that is part of the answer. It's about, and a lot of the message of my book is about listening to other people's anger. It's not so much some message about, like, go out and rage on, right? Because it's a book that aims to describe, in part, the penalties that are still in place for marginalized people and for women who do yell and scream and show their anger, that there are repercussions. But what we need to do is change the way that women's anger is received. And the first step in that is by listening to the anger of other women, being curious about it, asking about it, respecting it, and really hearing what the anger is about, including if some of that anger is at us. And I have hope. I mean, this is a really hard question, and I'm acutely aware of the fact that I am a white feminist who is taking up a great deal of my own space right now. I am acutely aware of these dynamics. And to be optimistic about the future of this is a very white feminist thing to be, right? Like, oh, I think this can really work out. Great. I think that part of the process that's happened over the past couple years, if you look at the Women's March and how that came about, that was a process. It was the organizing process. The Women's March was the idea for it came from two white women on election night, the election night where 94% of black women had voted for Hillary Clinton and 53% of white women had voted for Donald Trump. And that night, two white women, very, well-intentioned white women, had the idea of having a march on Washington. And what white organizers first wanted to call it was the Million Women's March, which is the name of a protest that had been led by black women years before that they did not know, and they appropriated the name. And there was enormous discord about the racial inequalities within the planning of that march. But one of the things that happened is that women of color came in from other movements to take over the leadership. They insisted that the march was going to be about a series of principles and a series of fights that were interlocked, so that it wasn't just going to be about women who were angry at Donald Trump's election or women who were angry about abortion. It was going to be about reproductive justice, which is a movement to address a much vaster set of inequalities. It was going to be about environmental racism. It was going to be about workers' rights, domestic workers' rights. And there were going to be a series of movements, and we were going to have a conversation about how all these oppressions are interconnected, and you can't just pick one out without the other. And it was hard. There were fights. A lot of the coverage of it was how divided it was and how divisive it was, with the women of color always cast as the divisive ones, right? For challenging the more powerful in the dynamic. And Linda Sarsour told me, who was one of the leaders of the march, told me in the days before the march, she said, and this was echoing Audre Lorde, contentious dialogue is by design. We're not going to get through this by not listening to the anger. If we're going to get through it, and it remains an open question, if we're going to move to someplace better and more inclusive, we got to air the anger and listen to it and let it change us. And the powerful have to learn to listen to and be led by those who have historically been excluded and marginalized from their coalitions.
This seems like a good place to hear a short excerpt. And this is from the beginning of the book,
yes.
Right? Where
yeah.
You're kind of setting up where we'll go with you.
Yeah, I'm writing about how there are stories of women's furious protests that exist in other cultures. While we in the United States may not have been told the stories, our nation, too, has been transformed by women's anger in response not just to sexism, but also to racism, homophobia, capitalist excess, to the many inequities to which women and those around them have been exposed. In A Place of Rage, a 1991 documentary about black women activists and artists, the poet June Jordan, whose writing was a tender chronicle of rage at having her liberties restricted because I am the wrong sex, the wrong age, the wrong skin, recalled the event that brought her to her political and ideological sensibilities. In her childhood in Bedford-Stuyvesant in Brooklyn, a young man in her neighborhood was beaten on his roof by the police in a case of mistaken identity. To see this boy I idolized, who belonged to us in the sense of our block, disfigured by these strangers who came in with all this force and license to use that force, was really terrifying. And also, it hardened me early in a kind of place of rage. It's crucial to remember that women's anger has been received and often vilified or marginalized in ways that have reflected the very same biases that provoked it. Black women's fury is treated differently from white women's rage. Poor women's frustrations are heard differently from the ire of the wealthy. Yet despite the varied and unjust ways America has dismissed or derided the rages of women, those rages have often borne substantive change, alterations to the nation's rules and practices, its very fabric. This book is about women so angry at slavery and lynching that they risked their lives and reputations and pioneered new forms of public expression for women, including speeches in front of mixed gender and mixed race audiences. About women so furious at their lack of a franchise that they walked 150 miles from New York City to Albany to petition for the vote, went on hunger strikes, and protested outside the White House. Women so angry that they stayed angry for the decades, their lifetimes, that it took to get the right to vote, first via the 19th Amendment and then the Voting Rights Act, their rage leading them to acts of civil disobedience, marches and sit-ins and voting when it was not legal to do so, for which they would be jailed, beaten. Women who took conversations that had historically been whispered and chose instead to broadcast them via open-air rallies and in the pages of newspapers and in lawsuits and in front of political conventions and judiciary committees.
You're listening to Talking Volumes at the Fitzgerald Theater with writer Rebecca Traister. Her new book is titled Good and Mad, The Revolutionary Power of Women's Anger. And I'm Carrie Miller. You have a section called What's the Matter with White Women? Mm. And you reference research that I think that is going to make some women here uncomfortable. And that's about how marriage and voting patterns and race intersect. What's the research say about married white women in voting patterns?
They vote Republican.
Why?
Well, I mean, this ties... It's interesting because my last book was about unmarried women.
Right.
Both a contemporary move away from marriage, which is happening in sort of unprecedented numbers, the delay of marriage for so many women and a move away from it, and also the history of women who lived outside of marriage.
This was all the single ladies, by the way, if you want to buy the book.
Yeah, right. It's called All the Single Ladies, and it was published in 2016. And I published it and looked at some of the political trends. And unmarried, white women have historically voted Republican. And in its contemporary iteration, what that means is voting for a party that represents white patriarchal interests. And within the larger group of white women, the group that, for example, voted for Barack Obama over Mitt Romney in 2012 was never married white women. Now, when the exit polls first closed in 2016, it looked like all white women had voted for Donald Trump. But in fact, there was later research done that actually pulled the votes apart by marital status. And what these researchers did was find that once again, the population of women who voted for Hillary Clinton over Donald Trump were the never married women. And the ones who are most likely to vote for him were married or widowed women. And then with, you know, decreasing, like, separated, divorced, to never married. Mm-hmm. So that the more distant you were from marriage, the more likely you were to vote left. And, you know, the left, such as it is constituted in the United States right now, is the party that better represents a series of economic policies that better support independence from marriage. Marriage, for a long time, historically, was used as a organizing principle, how you organized power between genders, that you were sort of forcibly, socially and economically and sexually, paired off into marriage and an institution that said one member of this partnership did the public work, had the economic, the political, the professional power, and one member did the domestic work and the child rearing, and did not have economic or legal or public power. And there was a dependence economically on these men. There was also a reverse dependence. White men have needed, I mean, men have historically needed women to do the domestic work that supports their ability to go out into the public sphere. But of course, that dependence doesn't, there's not an economic dependence there, mm-hmm. right? And dependence creates a whole series of incentives for women to want to defend and bolster the power, whether it's the earning power or the public power or the social status of the men on whom they themselves are dependent for proximal power. And that is a lot of what leads them to vote for. It's people like to say, oh, women are voting against their own interests. And when it comes to patriarchal inequality, yes. But when it comes to white supremacy, no. They're voting for their own.
And to some degree, economic, I mean, maybe not consciously, but implicitly, economic security too, right?
Right, right. Voting for what? Right. Voting for their own interests insofar as they are economically attached to and dependent on a population that either is going to benefit or thinks it's going to benefit with right-wing policies. Now, one of the other dynamics here is that this is about a right-wing that has gone to great pains to disguise the fact that it is starving 99% of the population and putting into place policies that don't necessarily benefit all white people or all white men, but rather benefit the very richest and most wealthy in this country. But they have disguised the way that they have opened up this horrific chasm between the very wealthy and everyone else and lots of people and the very poor, in part by supplying storylines, which the country has always been very open to receiving, right? This isn't forced down the throat of white America. But there's also been a right-wing sort of supplies storylines about immigrants who are coming for your jobs, about the way that certain kinds of people in the United States take things from the government, like free stuff from the government. Those are things that Republican candidates include, not just Donald Trump, Rick Santorum, Mitt Romney. This is the kind of stuff that has been sold, which amplifies a sense of racial resentment and a kind of racialized and to some degree gendered narrative of why white populations and white men are losing status. But where there's real movement and change over the past couple years are in white suburban women who have previously been kind of either politically apathetic or maybe Democratic voters who have not been vocal about their political opinions. And those are some of the women that I've been interviewing who have been really activated over the past couple of years, who got livid in the wake of Donald Trump's victory. And one of the things that anger can do, we talk a lot about anger as divisive and combative and the ways that it's bad for us. One of the ways that I'm trying to point out that anger can be good for us is that it can make connection. And it's the story of these suburban white women that is an example that helped me to see this. I went to Georgia last summer and talked to some of the women who had previously, they lived in sort of red conservative communities. They maybe voted Democratic, but they'd never even so much as put a lawn sign out because they felt it would be disruptive within their community, their conservative community. And they kind of kept quiet about it. They didn't want to be the skunk at the party. They didn't want any of the blowback that they would get for being the dissenting opinion. Most of them had assumed that Hillary Clinton was going to win because she had all the power. She was the establishment, and Trump's racism and misogyny was going to be disqualifying. And then when she didn't, they were so shocked that they let their anger out. They kind of couldn't help it anymore. And they screamed. And the crazy thing that happened is that when they got angry enough that they expressed it, they discovered that a woman down the street on their same block was angry too. And they might have been living on that block for decades together, but because they'd been quiet, they'd never known that this other person existed. But then when they yelled, they became audible to each other. And when they became audible to each other, they started to talk about their shared frustrations and their anger. And then they went to like an indivisible meeting. And then they started organizing and they made their own group, the Liberal Moms of Roswell and Cobb Counties. And then that group split into other groups. And by the time I got to them last summer, they were spending their every waking hour registering voters, knocking on doors. Now that was in the lead up to the John Ossoff election. They'd done it for other candidates in local races that had preceded that one. And Ossoff lost and I was very nervous. I was like, what's going to happen in the wake of these newly awakened activists and their candidate lost? They are still going strong. When we talk about what's going to happen with white suburban women who voted Republican, these are not women who probably, some of them may have voted Republican in the past. Some of the women I talked to, you know, had sort of gone back and forth but a lot of them are people who just have never put their energies into civic engagement like this before. And I think that's an effect that we can't measure. I don't know that it's going to have an impact, but they are out there getting people to the polls. They're going to be driving people to the polls. They've been registering voters. I hope it's going to help to alter the electorate, if not alter the minds and voting patterns of people who are really set with their party affiliation. It's bringing new voters in and new levels of enthusiasm and engagement in.
I've been also curious about, as you've been traveling, whether at some of the book events you're hearing from women about their Me Too experiences.
Oh, yeah. One of the things, you know, when we talk about the Me Too movement in its most recent iteration, in the hashtag Me Too movement, which of course comes after Tarana Burke's Me Too movement, it's a fraction of the stories. It feels like, and there have been hundreds of, you know, men who have been publicly identified as alleged harassers or predators. And it feels like so many. And yet, because of my work and because I write about this and I talk about it publicly, for everyone that's public, I've heard hundreds more that are not public. And even though it feels like this massive eruption, and it is a massive eruption with consequence, it's still just the tip of the iceberg.
I don't think you wrote about it in this book, but you wrote a piece about having had your own experience with Harvey Weinstein.
I did, and it is in this book,
okay,
actually.
So
yeah.
Remind me about, you thought high time when the New York Times exposed
him. Many journalists had known and had tried to report this story for years. I did have my own run-in with him. It was not sexual assault. But when I was a young reporter, I was 25 years old, and it was my first job in journalism. I was a fact-checker and junior reporter, and my job was to cover the film industry in New York City, the sort of financing of it and the production of it. And it was actually my first reported story, and it was about a movie that Harvey Weinstein's company was holding up from release, and there were some politics involved. And in fact, this story took place the night before the 2000 election, so the night before the Bush-Gore election, and which is so... And there you have it, the story of the past 18 years. And I was a young reporter, and nobody would return my calls from Miramax, which was Harvey Weinstein's company. And so my editor said, well, Harvey's hosting a party downtown tonight, a book party, like a launch party for a book that his company was publishing. And your colleague, my then colleague, who's a couple years older than me, who is a gossip columnist, he's going to cover it. So just go with Andrew. And you'll get Harvey, you can ask him the question, then you can publish the story. You just need him to comment on the record. So I went down to the party and I asked him the question, and he gave a totally nothing burger answer. Like, it was just enough to say, when asked about this, Weinstein replied, blah, 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 nothing. And then I said, okay, thanks, and went off to go get my bag. And Harvey got angry. And he said, you know, that wasn't on the record. And I actually don't know how I had the wherewithal to reply. I said, well, of course it was on the record, Harvey. I mean, I identified myself as a reporter and held out a tape recorder. and you didn't say it was off the record. And he became irate, and he began pushing me physically and screaming, total obscenity laced, and he pushing me in the shoulder, called me the C word, I'm not allowed to say the things that he said, but you can Google like Harvey Weinstein and sheriff of this town, and you'll find just an expletive laced string of things that he said. And it was terrifying. He's an enormous man. This was in public. It was so out of control. It was a public party with reporters there and people drinking cocktails and like eating cheese. And he was screaming at a 25-year-old year old reporter. And my colleague came in and calmed him down and said, tell me about this book party, and calmed him down. And I sort of got our bags and I was like, okay, let's go. And then my colleague asked him to apologize to me.
And that's, for which you were owed, right?
I did not care about being apologized to. I cared about getting the hell out of there. And that set him off. And at that point, he went nuts on my colleague, who, you know, I think was 27 or 28 at the time. And he pushed him down a step, and he fell over backwards holding a tape recorder, hit a woman in the head. She passed out. And then Harvey started screaming, he hit a woman. And he took my colleague out onto the street in 6th Avenue in Manhattan, outside of the Tribeca Grand Hotel. And he put my colleague in a headlock and started punching the top of his head. And here was among the many things that I learned that night, which was a hugely formative experience. There were a dozen reporters, gossip columnists, photographers there. I was out on that street corner, sort of not knowing what to do, screaming, stop, stop. And there were flashes going off. I never saw a single one of those photos.
That's just, oh my God.
To this day. I sort of thought when I wrote about it after everything, like somebody would send me one of those photos. No, they were gone. They were destroyed.
What does that tell you?
Power. This is about power. One of the things we like to comfort ourselves, among the many things we like to comfort ourselves by telling ourselves, is that if this is about individual abuses and bad apples, and if we can just get rid of a couple of bad apples, we will have fixed the problem. What we don't want to acknowledge is that this is a systemic reality. This is about power and who's been offered a disproportionate share of it, and how all of our institutions and our media and the stories we tell ourselves about this country are shaped around that power imbalance. My friends and I write about this in the book, and that coming to grips with this, like individual men would be sort of, you know, written about, and then many of them would lose their jobs, some of them wouldn't, and there was this sort of patting on the back, like, oh, we're fixing the problem. And my friends and I began to talk about Get Out, the horror movie. And I realized we kept making reference to it, and there are a couple things, you know, I had one friend who reported on Charlie Rose and the more than 30 women who alleged that he'd assaulted and harassed them when they were his young employees. And at one point she said to me about this whole process, you know, that it reminded her of the Allison Williams scene in Get Out, where it's revealed that Allison Williams is also part of the problem, and she used to trust no one was the thing. And I realized that the big mainstream story wanted it to be a horror movie like that was about a Freddy or a Jason. They wanted it to be Halloween, so we could just kill one bad guy and be done. But that the reality was that it was Get Out, because it's about the entire system being rigged against you.
I think the way you can see that is now how some of these men who have been shamed out of their positions of power are trying to re-enter, yes, with the assistance of other men, magazine editors who are saying, yes, write a long piece about what this was like to go through being shamed, mm-hmm, with not one bit of acknowledgement about what it was like to live through it.
Well,
right? As the person who was harassed.
That gets back to the way that power works. When the less powerful challenge the more powerful, it is seen as a disruptive assault. That's how Me Too, which is essentially about women just telling the stories,
right,
of their lives, right? The women aren't the ones who are deciding whether to fire or dismiss or punish the men, right? These are women often who've been exiled from the very professions in which these men hold all this power and have been earning millions of dollars. It's about women simply saying what happened to them.
Right.
And yet they're cast as witch hunt. It's a witch hunt. This is the way that the women who have no power, as they yell about not having been believed by a Senate Judiciary Committee or by the Senate itself, as it confirmed Brett Kavanaugh to a lifetime appointment on the Supreme Court, where he will have the power to make decisions about their bodily autonomy, their economic and voting rights. They're called a mob, and Donald Trump has compared them to arsonists. Those who, I write in this the moment where I understood how these dynamics worked. It should have been the Harvey incident back in 2000, because he pushed us. And if you look back, and I only discovered this when I looked back at how it had been covered, because it was written about the next day in the New York Times and the New York Post. And he had the power to spin it. And the way he spun it was a couple of pushy reporters had come and confronted him at a party. We were the pushy ones, even though he had done the physical pushing. He had the power to cast us as the aggressors. This is why the I didn't understand that at the time. The moment it came clear to me was actually, I believe, in 2015, the year that Freddie Gray was killed in Baltimore. And he was taken by police on a rough ride, and he died later of his injuries. And there were protests in Baltimore afterward. And all the news coverage that I saw of that said that the violence began when protesters threw rocks. The violence that had been done to Freddie Gray, the violence done by the more powerful entity to the less powerful entity, was so normalized, that's just power, that it wasn't even discernible as violence. But when the less powerful challenged by throwing a rock or telling their own story or protesting in a Senate hallway, they are discernible. It's a disruption of the power system. And so they are immediately discernible as the chaotic, threatening menace. And the powerful who've been challenged, especially when they are white men who we've been told from the beginning are our normative citizens, who we are trained to empathize with, who are the voices on our radio and on our morning television who explain the world to us, who we've been permitted to see and get to know because they have the power to make themselves visible and known to us. The impulse is to see things from their perspective, because it's their perspective that's been offered to us as the view of the world. Mm-hmm. And the nameless crowds of powerless people aren't known to us. That's the whole point. They haven't had the opportunity to be our translators and our leaders and our storytellers. And so our sympathy redounds to the powerful. And the deep discomfort of when there is challenge to that power, and it's uncomfortable. When we have these moments of radical disruption, it's scary. I'm the biggest proponent of Me Too in the world. And the period last fall, when these stories were coming in a flood was horrible. It was painful because of the pain of the people who were telling their stories, but it was also scary. We were anticipating the backlash, understanding that we were already in backlash. We're getting the backlash now. The backlash is all around us, right? But it was also scary. Are we going too far? Is there going to be a mistake? Is somebody going to believe the wrong story? Like, it's terribly scary to be in these moments where the power structure is actually challenged. But if we want to make change, we have to create the chaos. We have to be radical or rebellious, revolutionary, insurrectionists. That's one of the things that lots of people throughout history talk about in this book. But that is perilous. And one of the reasons it's perilous is because of how swiftly and immediately those who take part in the insurrections will be cast as the villains.
You write about the rage of the founders, right? The revolutionary rage of the founders. This is something we don't understand that well. What do we miss about that?
Well, here's the rage of the founders is the rage that we've been taught to revere as politically consequential, right? This is the rage at inequality that, man, we have been, it is our national lullaby, right? Give me liberty or give me death, live free or die, let's throw tea in a harbor, which, by the way, if anybody other than white men had done, would have been called like a temper tantrum or incivil and, you know, a mob, yep. Witch hunt. That is, you know, that's our national lullaby. Now, of course, and we understand it, we're taught it as righteous, right? They're angry about representational inequity. They are being governed and policed by a government that does not include them representationally. And so, yes, that is righteous. And it causes a revolution in the birth of a new nation. But what is that new nation built on? The genocide of the native population first, and then the repetition of the very inequities that they so righteously objected to. Governing a population and benefiting, building an economy on its labor, both the labor of the enslaved and the labor of the unpaid labor of women, building an economy on the labor of those who are not acknowledged as human in our founding documents, who are not permitted equal civic engagement, who are not permitted a franchise, who are denied legal and economic equality in all its forms, and who are fundamentally not represented in the government that makes the laws over their bodies. And one of the fascinating things is that of that majority, again, on which the country was built, the subjugated and oppressed and unrepresented majority, as they have voiced their righteous rage at their lack of representation, their enslavement, they have often borrowed the language, that righteous language, of the founders. Whether that is, I tell the story in the book of a woman named Mum Bett, later known as Elizabeth Freeman, who was enslaved in Massachusetts and who worked in the home of a man who was involved in revolutionary politics. And she heard the revolutionary rhetoric in her home and she applied it to her own condition and petitioned for her freedom. And in fact, she won her freedom and her case became one of the bases for the abolition of slavery in Massachusetts in 1783. But we're not taught about her righteous rage. We're not taught about the young women in the Lowell Mills in New England, in the textile mills, whose early walkouts in the formation of a union was one of the first iterations of what would become the labor movement in the United States, and whose initial petitions included borrowing the rage of the founders. So as our forefathers resisted the bloody avarice of England, we resist the bloody avarice of the mills in which we're toiling for low wages and in dangerous working conditions. So one of the other famous riffs on revolutionary rhetoric comes in 1848 with the Declaration of Sentiments, which is written by Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was a suffragist and a racist. And she was a tremendous writer about inequality. And it's fascinating to read the Declaration of Sentiments now and think about how resonant it remains.
I asked Rebecca if we could do something a little unusual, which is, do you ever hear that NPR thing where they read the Declaration of Independence and they have all the different, yeah. So I asked her if we could do that, if written 170 years ago at the Seneca Falls Convention, if she and I could go back and forth and read the words that were written down by women back then. You begin.
All right. This is a list of man's tyranny over woman. He has never permitted her to exercise her inalienable right to the elective franchise.
He has compelled her to submit to laws in the formation of which she had no voice.
He has made her, if married, in the eye of the law, civilly dead.
He has taken from her all right in property, even to the wages she earns.
In the covenant of marriage, she is compelled to promise obedience to her husband, he becoming to all intents and purposes her master, the law giving him power to deprive her of her liberty and to administer chastisement.
He has so framed the laws of divorce as to be wholly regardless of the happiness of women, the law in all cases going upon a false supposition of the supremacy of man and giving all power into his hands.
He has monopolized nearly all the profitable employments, and from those she is permitted to follow, she receives but scanty remuneration.
He closes against her all the avenues to wealth and distinction, which he considers most honorable to himself. As a teacher of theology, medicine, or law, she is not known.
He has denied her the facilities for obtaining a thorough education, all colleges being closed against her.
He allowed her in church as well as state, but a subordinate position.
He has endeavored in every way he could to destroy her confidence in her own powers, to lessen her self-respect, and to make her willing to lead a dependent and abject life.
It's remarkable how prescient and relevant the words are, isn't it, to today?
It is. And that's not all of it. You should look it up. It's incredible.
Ready?
I'm ready.
All right, we'll bring up the house lights. We have microphones. I'll carry one. Microphones up in the balconies, too. Just raise your hand. Hi. Question here.
I guess my question to you is, at what point did you realize, one, your privilege in the space? Like, what was that process like for you? Because I think there's a lot of people in the community, right, that white guilt face. You know, people are very confused sometimes. They're like, I don't necessarily know. Like, how long did it last for you, or what point did you decide that you were going to use the space that you were in, the platform that you had for strength, and that recognizing, one, you know, the privilege that you have in that space, but then utilizing it and not staying in that guilt phase. Because I think that some places in my community, like, that's, you know, what people have. You know, we're
right.
Talking about, like you said, systemic change in places that we're trying to be at. And so that's always interesting to me in having that conversation. But yeah, it's a pleasure to be here, and I'm really glad.
I am so glad you came.
Thank you. Okay, so, and your question is, thank you also for that question, which is so good, about particularly with regard to white women and white feminists, like TM, right? Like, about how do you reckon with race without either doing weird performative self-flagellation or paralysis and guilt, right? And I don't know that I'm doing it right, but I can tell you there are two phases of this for me that I could sort of describe about coming to consciousness. One is about when I started as a feminist journalist in, you know, 15 years ago, my feminist writing was pretty rudimentary. I didn't have a lot of women's history. I didn't have a lot of history of about race or inequality. I mean, I was coming at this, like, sort of, you know, gut level, and I was wrong about a lot of stuff, or incomplete in so much stuff. And so one of my first lessons is in listening to the people who challenged me on what I was wrong about. And again, it doesn't mean like self-flagellation, I can never write about this again. It's like when I was pushed to be more thoughtful and learn more, it did just that. It pushed me to try to get better. And it's a slow process, and it's not like I got better, right? It's like I tried to think more and differently and read more and listen more and think about things from different perspectives. So in part, it's that. It's not about, like, I hope, I mean, is not about just sort of shaming yourself out of the conversation, and certainly not about being like overly aggrieved and like it's about, okay, listen, again, the value of listening to anger, including anger, some of which is directed at you. That doesn't mean you have to agree with every bit of anger, like, oh, yes, the person who's angry about me is right about everything. It's like, listen for what resonates. And a lot of the challenge that I got about my writing and its whiteness resonated for me and made me want to learn more. That's phase one. And then there's a second very specific answer to your question. The week... about in terms of what I feel like my responsibility is here. And the week before the 2016 election, I was on a panel of women. It was like a podcast recording. And it was women who, I was the journalist, there were a couple journalists, and then there were a lot of activists who were out banging doors for Hillary. And some of these activists had been like ardent, devoted Bernie Sanders supporters, you know, did not come to Hillary Clinton easily, but were out there knocking those doors. Some of them had been ardent Hillary supporters who were out there doing the work. And everybody was talking about the process of being out there in the days before this election, the desperation about getting out the people, getting out the vote. And one of the women on that panel, I believe it was Michaela Angela Davis, who's a incredible activist and speaker, said something that just hit me in the gut. She was talking about young white men on the left, right, who, you know, many of whom gravitated toward the Bernie Sanders campaign. And she was sort of saying, like, why aren't the, look, we know white men are Trump's base demographic. Why aren't I seeing more of these young white left guys out here knocking doors in advance of this election? And the phrase she used was, come get your boy. Come on, guys, come get your boys. And it really struck me because one of the things that I realized is that we so rarely hear white people called to be responsible for their demographic, much less white men. And it really, I was like, oh, you can demand of white men that they take responsibility for their own demographic? Huh, that's interesting. So then the next week, you know, I'm sitting there with election results, and I was not surprised by the 53% of white women because I know in my writing about women in politics that again, that white women have historically, as long as they've been counting and before that, supported, a majority of them have supported fundamentally conservative politics. So I wasn't surprised by the 53%, but I felt those words resonated in my head. Like, what is my, and I was really battling with what is my work going forward. And I knew that at least part of my work was going to get my girls. Now, that doesn't mean that it's working. but I felt a tremendous responsibility. Like, so often, something that angers me about, like, the way that Congress works is that it's the women who go out and are on the committees about sexual harassment and assault and reproductive rights. And it's so often women of color who are out there educating people about race. Well, white people have race, too. And it is my response, and it is not the responsibility of women of color to go get white women and educate them. So who is going to do that work if not white women? And I felt a real responsibility to acknowledge that writing about race also means writing about whiteness. And so that's what has undergirded this particular book and the things I'm talking about now. And in fact, the way that I have come to see the world, my thinking changes all the time and every day. And it's like a very long process. And so, but that was the turning point for me.
Thanks so much for being here. I'm going back to something you said earlier about how the Republicans keep splitting up the majority and getting these, you know, coalition, giving a little bit to each, whether it's white women or something else. And what makes you hopeful, or what do you think are the specific steps to break that barrier? Overall, the minority is ruling us with the Electoral College and the power of all these other states with far less population.
Mm. I think that we're looking at two realities happening simultaneously. One is that minority power, and again, you know, I talked about minority power is white patriarchal power, but it is also in a party and a president that was not elected by popular majority. And as you said, a Senate where the power is in the party that represents fewer Americans by a factor of many millions. We are in the grip of both white patriarchal minority rule and partisan minority rule. That party represents the power of the white patriarchy. And they have tremendous power to suppress the mechanisms of dissent. That is the project of the court, right? That is what it means to take away reproductive autonomy, voting rights, collective bargaining rights. It is suppressing the power of the masses to rise up and resist. And that is a reality that means that we are going to be spending the rest of our lives fighting this powerful's ability to suppress our ability to fight back. But the hope that I have is in, I mean, I have to hope that we can form coalitions. If I didn't hope, then what would we do? Hope is a tactical necessity. And part of that hope comes in talking about the way that majorities have been divided against themselves. And it doesn't mean sending a message. It's like, let's override that and work together despite our differences. I fall on the side tactically of let's air our differences. Let's voice our anger. And that's why I urge people to listen to the anger of the people they might be in coalition with. Listen to it, take it in, learn from it. Let's try to do it differently. We have to try to get better. That's part of the project in front of progressives, is to do it better as we move forward. And the better we can do it, the better chance we have of ever overcoming these mechanisms that are being set up against us.
Question right down here.
Using the example of Elizabeth Warren as sort of a case study in her announcement about her native heritage, is it important when we're dealing with really angry people, which we all have to deal with at times, or somewhat angry, is it important to have a strategy to deal with that anger on the one hand? And on the other hand, there's a reaction of the First Nation people who are questioning her.
Yeah. The Elizabeth Warren set of choices that she made has been... I have thought 50 different ways about it in the past 48 hours. And I don't have a lot of clarity about it, except that I think that it embodies a lot of the conflicts that I'm talking about in this book. I have to confess that I've been on book tour, I'm sort of running around, I'm not getting a chance to like read the news as carefully as I might otherwise. And when I first saw the headline, I didn't think it was bad, which also reflects some of what I don't know in the world or what I hadn't thought of about the way that, I mean, I thought, oh, you know, I don't know what I thought. Like, what was I thinking? Like, oh, she got him now. Like, well, that'll just take care of that, right? The things I did not think about in my instantaneous reaction were how this plays into wrong concepts about what constitutes race to begin with, and that race is a social construction, and that the kind of blood rule stuff has been put to incredibly pernicious purposes throughout our history. I know that intellectually. I know all that intellectually. I've, in some cases, you know, sort of written about it, thought about it, talked about it, but it wasn't an instantaneous connection for me. I mean, you know, within like an hour it was. But I certainly didn't know enough about the history or the positions of the Cherokee Nation. And one of the things that I've been thinking about is, and I mentioned this before, when those who have less power voice the challenge to the powerful, they're cast as the divisive ones. And, you know, I profiled Elizabeth Warren this summer. I really like Elizabeth Warren as a politician. I really believe in the kinds of policies that she fights for. I admire her tremendously. And I think it's, and I think that there are a lot of people out there who, like Elizabeth Warren, who are frustrated by the kind of dissent, but by the challenge being made by people who have less power than she does. And I'm acutely aware of the fact that the people who have less power will get cast as the divisive and destructive ones, right? Oh, why can't we have this good thing, a progressive candidate? You know? Oh, because we're factionalizing. But that's part of the narrative in which those who have the least voice when they raise it get cast as the disruptors. And so I'm thinking about that. There's this whole other question of, do you play into the hands of a bully? You know, Obama eventually showed his birth certificate. But did that take away the narrative of illegitimacy on which Donald Trump built his entire political career? No. It was, in fact, the anger that undergirded that claim of his illegitimacy that was part of what powered him to the presidency, to take Barack Obama's job after Obama left it. What's happened over the past couple days with regard to Elizabeth Warren has left me very upset. I think it's a real problem, and I think the anger, especially the anger being voiced by native groups and indigenous people, we need to listen to. And I hope that she's listening to it and her team is listening to it. And that's the thing I would ask, is that we all listen carefully to what's being said and the kind of inequities in history that are being described, and that we all take it seriously, and that she and her team take it seriously and try to figure out how to make this contentious dialogue generative, as Audre Lorde or Linda Sarsour might say.
We've gone a little late because I just didn't want to end the conversation. So how about two more questions, one right up there and then one right here.
Hi. One of the things I'm struck by in this moment is how much of what we want to tear down and fix and build up in the world comes back to things we need to sort of tear down and fix and build up in ourselves as women. One of the ways that's played out for me is one of my personal responses to the Me Too moment was to stop dyeing my hair. As a 37-year-old woman, I have gray hair, and I've been dyeing it for years, and I stopped. I'm just interested in how you're seeing, in how you personally are looking for ways to kind of uproot the patriarchy that has taken root in your own mind, and how you're seeing other women do the same.
That's a great question. I think writing a book and going on tour talking about how angry I am is one of the chief ways, because, and I write about, this book is not about me or my anger, but I do write in brief passages about how obviously anger has informed and undergirded so much of my work as a feminist journalist, but I took great pains in the early parts of my career to obscure it and make it palatable and funny and cheeky and ironic, and to make sure I wasn't so angry that nobody was going to listen to me because they were going to write me off as hysterical. And I guess I've kind of cast some of that off. I think, so there's another book that I really want to recommend by Soraya Chemaly. It's called Rage Becomes Her. And it, I think, gets to the heart of some of the things you're pointing out about it. It deals more than mine with the psychological messages that women are sent from their childhoods about how not to express their anger or how to think of their anger as something else, sadness. You know, to how women are trained in all these ways from a very early age to disguise or not look directly at the anger they feel personally. She's also writing about political dynamics, too. But I think that, you know, I think that part of what you're describing is how the recognition of these patterns, again, the systemic, the architectural inequities, they're so systemic that they're not just in our government or our workplaces, that, as you say, they're in us, they're in our families, they're in our intimate relationships, they're in our relationships with ourselves and how we see ourselves and what we value and don't value in ourselves. And that is part of the process in any progressive movement one of the most catalytic things is getting a view of something. This is why Mamie Till's decision to have an open casket funeral for her son Emmett Till, who is 14 and horrifically beaten and left in a river after having been falsely accused of making a pass at a white woman. One of the reasons that that decision to make Emmett's brutalized body visible to as many people as possible is because it gave the world a view of what lynching was, of what the racial violence of the Jim Crow South. They couldn't look away from it anymore and pretend it didn't exist. And you see that over and over again. That's the streaming, that's part of the streaming videos of Philando Castile's murder, of the Black Lives Matter videos, how it becomes unavoidable. We can't look away. And part of the process that we're undergoing right now and that we're participating in, we are making visible the systems that have oppressed us. And once they become visible, it becomes hard for us to unsee them. And that's hard and difficult, and it alters our lives and some of our most intimate relationships. But it's also what we have to do if we actually want to begin taking those systems apart. We have to be able to see them first.
One last question, right here.
Hello, Rebecca. My name is Sina Hodges, and locally I have a business here, and I call myself the Woke Coach. I am the person who co-moderated the discussion with Carrie Miller, Me Too, and Making Allies. And Carrie and I have an ongoing conversation about what it takes to be a great ally. And we all know that it's using your privilege to lift up and amplify marginalized groups. And the distinction about being an ally, though, is that you have to be called that by the groups that you are working to amplify. So what I want to say is thank you for, in your work, rewriting narratives and lifting up Black women and women of color in your work, because I think that it's important that those stories are told and that they're told accurately. And I want to say that you are an ally. So that's important. And the piece about it, you know, when you see injustice, you just talked about seeing injustice, and what you do about it is the distinction, right? You see injustice, you know it exists, but then it's what do you do about it? So in a classic Get Your Girls moment, I'm going to ask you if, you know, I like to be solution-oriented too. You made a recommendation for a reading that people should do, but how did you come to your awakening? What did you read? What can people read? How can they engage? What things can they actively walk out of this space tonight and do in their lives going forward to work toward being better allies?
That's a great question. So in terms of reading, there are books I've mentioned, right? I mentioned Audre Lorde, her essay, The Uses of Anger, Sister Outsider. I mentioned Brittany Cooper, whose book was published in February. Everybody go buy Brittany Cooper's book, Eloquent Rage. It is an incandescent volume about Black feminist anger. Read When and Where I Enter. I mean, read the biography of Pauli Murray that was published a couple years ago. Read the biography of Anna Arnold Hegeman. There is scholarship that's being done out there that is reclaiming. It's how I got my education for this book. One of the things I need to do, actually, I need to put a full bibliography, which is not in the volume. I need to put that on my website. And your question actually makes me think I'm going to do that like now. Right? Okay. Because my education has been going to a bookstore and do this. Go and look in the sections that aren't put out on the front tables, right? Go and look in the Black history section, right? And the sort of academic books. I'm not a scholar. I'm so aware of the fact that I borrow so much of my work from the work of scholars who've spent their entire lives doing this from an academic and primary source perspective. But there is scholarship out there. I went and bought the book, like the Penguin Anthology of Early Black Women Orators, right? To learn about Mariah Stewart, who is the first woman to address a mixed race audience. This is again in the 1830s, I believe. Mixed race and, you know, mixed gender. This is some of the groundbreaking work of how women's voices get heard in different ways. I went and I got a academic thing you'd read in college. there's so go to those sections that you might not ordinarily go to. This is so when I say be curious about the anger of other women, there's also the daily stuff. Ask the women in your lives, ask the women of color, ask the people of color, what are you angry about? So many women I interviewed for this book said, you're the first woman who's ever asked me what I'm angry about, right? So start asking that question of the people around you, but also start asking it of your libraries and bookstores, right? Go to the history and find out what people are angry about. Find a book, go, you know, find, read the biography of Pauli Murray and then look up the people's names in the Pauli Murray biography and see if there are books written about them. Also, seek out, volunteer to work for candidates. Because we've got one tool on the table right now, and it's elections. And those elections are perverted. Free and fair elections? I don't know. There's massive suppression. Massive suppression. That means we have to work harder to get out the vote, drive people to vote, knock on doors, spend every available moment you have helping people to vote. There are organizations, there are a lot of them that are listed, that are named in my book. Spread the Vote, an organization founded by a woman named Kat Calvin, that helps people, the arduous process, it takes so long and it's such delicate, painstaking work of getting people in voter ID states the ID they need. It's truly like one voter at a time. She's doing that work. Look her up. Sister District that connects you to districts. If you're in a safe district, go to Sister District and find out where you can best put your energy, your money, your time. Higher Heights, which works to elect women of color. There are organizations that are run for something that works to bring young people, young progressives, into the political process for the first time so that you have 23-year-old candidates who are being supported by an organization. This is also, I think, also a form of being an ally because we're working to protect and better the government, right? The representative system. And that is being an ally to the people who are the most vulnerable. So, conversational and daily curiosity about the people who may be angry in your life, who either don't feel confident about their ability to express it and be heard and respected in their anger, seek them out. Ask them, let them know that you're listening to them and that you're interested and take what they say to heart to let it change the way you think about the world. Seeking out the reading, going to find the history that we're not taught. It takes some effort, but it's there. And then when you learn it, telling other people about it because you're going to be shocked. You're going to read it and you're going to be like, I can't believe this happened in 1836. It's really amazing stuff. And then civic engagement. And I want to say one more thing. We might not win, but don't let that stop you. Because if it stops you, then we have lost forever.